So the Open University interviews all start in the same place, and they start with the question, when did you first get interested in energy?
When I read a book written or co-authored by Albert Einstein when I was 14 years old, and when, of course, you see that law of conservation of energy is actually governing all bodies in the universe and actually also our practical life. And I revisited the energy issue, of course, as a physicist and later on as a climate scientist many times. But it is amazing that energy, or actually the conservation of energy, has to do with the homogeneity of time. That is what very few people know. So it's the most fundamental thing in our cosmos, actually, yeah? And this is a long way to go to understand that, but it's a lot of fun.
I've done many of these interviews now. Nobody yet has told me they got interested in energy because of Einstein, so congratulations on that one.
Yeah, I mean, I tried to be original and not ever succeeding.
And here you are working in, the building's called Albert Einstein, isn't it, on the science park?
No, actually in this very room where we sit, Karl Schwarzschild solved Einstein's field equations, the famous black hole solution, and later on sat here with Albert and discussed things. And so this is the room and this is the building where Einstein, Schwarzschild, Michelson, all these giants of physics worked. And
so the spirit of Einstein is among us?
It rubs off a little bit.
Okay, let's go further with this. I mean, what would he be saying if he was here now?
I mean, I have a quote from Einstein actually hanging here on the wall. It says, "The world will not be destroyed by those who do evil, but by those who watch them without doing anything." And I think that's in a way precisely what Albert Einstein would say today.
He was thinking of the Nazi threat, presumably.
No, he was thinking of nuclear arms race, actually. I mean, this is a late quote, okay. 1954 or something, yeah. Nowhere was the famous Russell Einstein Manifesto actually published in London in the 1950s, and he was just so worried about we are going to destroy our world simply because nobody wants to give in. I mean, the chicken game, so to speak, which could just bust the planet. But of course, he had this long, long experience of going through. In Germany, you know, you had the Kaiser and the Nazis and so on. You had to leave the country. So he was aware that human beings are very dangerous animals, actually.
And would you relate that so far as to go on to climate change? Do you think there's a parallel there, or is that too extreme a jump?
No, absolutely. I was actually, over the last 2 years or so, in particular also now, with all these populist movements in the UK, in the US, also in Germany, but less so. I was thinking a lot precisely about what you said and asked, what would Albert Einstein think? And when it comes to climate change, I mean, there are several aspects to that. On the one hand, people like Donald Trump certainly don't give a damn for climate science as such. They probably is more interested in getting people to Mars or some other extremely important things for humanity right now. But the problem is that as we more and more not only discover but corroborate is that the climate threat is so fundamental. I mean, recent papers where our institute was involved show that if you look at the historical data, you really go back in paleoclimate, into the paleoclimate records, and the climate sensitivity is rather such that under business as usual, this planet will warm by 5 to 6 degrees by the year 2100. That means 8, 12, whatever in 2300. That is the current insight. And if you look at that, it would mean the end of our civilization as we know it. And precisely at that point in time, where science knows the threat is tremendous, really, overwhelming, you have now all these reactionary movements which go against the scientific insights regarding climate change, but they go in general against the grain of the Enlightenment. That means in that very period of time where we need rational thinking the most, we are about to give it up. And if Albert Einstein would sit here, he would be extremely worried about that.
There are some people who accept that humans are contributing to climate change, but just say that given the observations that we've got, actually climate change may be less serious than we think, or may come upon us more slowly than we think. And they point out, and the Met Office agree to this, that the Met Office models are running slightly warm, producing slightly warmer projections than we're actually seeing. So therefore the suggestion is actually we don't need to worry quite so much.
Oh, I see what you mean. I think it's the other way around, really. I mean, I look at the data sets, of course. Also, the Met Office is, in a way, a sort of projecting and also, in a way, recording less warming than NASA data show and so on. No, there is a certain discrepancy. I'm sure it will be resolved soon, but let me say two things about it. I mean, first of all, 2014 was the warmest year on record. Then it was topped by 2015, and it will be topped by 2016 by probably a wide margin. In a stable climate, the probability for these happening in three consecutive years is 1 in 1,000,000 or something. So something is going on. And the acceleration, the change in global mean surface temperature is quite dramatic. So it's already 1 degree. If you now look into all the feedbacks and increases in CO2 concentration in the atmosphere under business as usual, we are clearly on this path towards 3, 4, 5, even 6 degrees change even by the end of the century. With a very high probability, I'm not talking about outliers, alarmist, you know, singular assumptions, whatever. This is middle-of-the-road projections. Maybe the Met Office is slightly below the middle-of-the-road projection. So what? The other thing is, and which is much more worrying, and that is our turf, clearly, this is the Institute for Climate Impact Research. We see that even this uncontested 1 degree warming, surface warming, is creating all types of very scary effects already. So you know precisely what droughts are doing, you know that, for example, the Syrian civil war was preceded by the biggest drought in the history in the region. So 85% of the cattle died in Syria. Millions of people had to go to the cities and so on. And you can just go on with all this observation. We see a major, I think just this week in Science, there's a major review about how from the genes up to entire populations, the world has been changed already and will be changed with global warming. So it's a review article with hundreds of citations. So everybody who is willing to see the light can see the light. And this is a very ugly light, actually.
And what state is politics in, do you think, to assess and to act on the science from the natural world?
I mean, just returning from Marrakesh, having been a member of the German delegation to Paris, the COP21, we live in a strange state of schizophrenia, I guess. I mean, I wrote an article together with colleagues in Nature Climate Change, why the right climate target was agreed in Paris. And I think it's a nice article that tells the story well why, you know, 1.5 to 2 degrees is the right target, if we can achieve it, but it is a good target because we would avoid the most dangerous non-linear effects of global warming, which clearly kick in beyond the 2 degrees line, let alone 3, 4, 5, 6 degrees. That would completely change the surface of the planet. But sometimes I make this bitter joke in the sense that I say, in a way, Paris is like prohibiting earthquakes of magnitude larger than 7 on the Richter scale. You know, the laws of physics are not passed by parliaments. They are there because the cosmos, the universe, is made up like this many billion years ago. It happened. And so it's wonderful to have the right target agreed, but having no plan whatsoever how it could be achieved. Now, we just written a paper, colleagues of mine and myself, how the carbon, the decarbonization roadmap would have to look like in order to have a chance, a decent chance, to hold the 2 degrees line, not even speaking about 1.5 degrees. And it means, just to give you some flavor of that, it means within the next 3-4 years, completely reform the European emissions trading system, open it when to China, California, and so on. This is a no-brainer option, actually. But do the no-brainer thing. In the decade between 2020 and 2030, you have to get rid of coal-fired power stations. You have to shut them down, let alone do not even think of building new ones. Get rid of the combustion engine on the roads by 2030. After 2030, don't build cities and buildings from concrete and steel anymore, but from wood, clay, stone, with some smart materials. And I could go on like this. So we have really added up all the innovation, the transformational elements you need in order to have a decent chance to deliver on 2 degrees. And this is the biggest transformation in the history of our civilization. So how can you be absolutely optimistic about that? There is a positive side effect, or actually it's a major effect, because we do think if that type of transformation would really be started, it would actually create a completely new dynamics in the world economy. Because if you own a coal mine these days, you cannot make much profit. And not even Donald Trump can bring back the profit to the coal industry. But if you invest, say, in electromobility, in smart new materials, in new forms of agriculture, where the customers go for, then this could create new jobs, new business cases, new value propositions, new dynamics, even new growth in the world economy. So we do think that saving the climate, in a way, is also the best business case in the world.
Let me just go back to talk about coal, because you mentioned an early phase out of coal. I've just spoken to the energy employers who say, yes, they agree coal has to be phased out, but there will be massive social implications and massive unemployment in some regions if coal is phased out too early.
This is ridiculous, actually, if you look at the real facts. I mean, I know we live in a post-factual era, but as a scientist, I'm forced to stick to the facts here. So let's just take the coal industry, lignite coal in eastern Germany, which is here in the state of Brandenburg.
That's where the greatest fears are from the point of view of the employers.
Precisely.
And the unions, too.
The unions, of course, are doing what unions need to do. They lobby for the interest of their customers. That's okay. But in the end, there are a number of different interests involved. But let me tell you this story. So when the German reunification happened, when the wall came down, the Berlin Wall came down, just in this area here in eastern Germany where we have lignite, about 90,000 jobs were directly related to lignite coal, 90,000. So today it's about 6,000. Of course, you can add all those who are somehow on the fringes, you know, people who indirectly make money by delivering certain parts that are needed. But in the end, you see, from 90,000 to 6,000, everybody can calculate what a shrinking or shrinkage in percentage it was. This was the normal economic dynamics, of course. It had only to do with market force. It had nothing to do with climate action. Nobody thought of that. And similar things happen in other places. So we talk about 6,000 jobs. But we talk also about 23 million tons of CO2 just emitted from one of these old coal-fired power stations, in Schwalde, for example. So if you calculate now the harm done to the atmosphere, the impacts done to future generations of these 6,000 jobs, why can we not just bail them out, so to speak? So what we propose is, we are not talking about the German automobile industry, where you have more than 1 million jobs. Converting that to electromobility will have all these social implications you talked about. But we talk about creating 6,000 new jobs, or putting people onto socially acceptable passage to whatever, retirement, whatever it is, this is not a big deal, actually. So what we propose is phase out coal here, but create a conversion fund, so to speak, by the state, by the European Union, whatever, to make these people sort of slide gently into either a different occupation or actually into retirement. And this has been done many times before in German history, everywhere around the world. So if you look at the dimension of the challenge, so to speak, the social challenge, and you look at the dimension of the planetary challenge, it's just hypocritical to say this cannot be solved. Of course it can be solved.
You must take some comfort from the fact that just a couple of days after Mr. Trump's election victory, the German government, after massive internal debate, actually came out with quite a strong plan for reducing emissions. Did it surprise you that the government had actually managed to achieve that sort of strength of plan, given the difficulty of political difficulty within the cabinet?
Now, first of all, it did not surprise me because I knew more or less what is going on. And I had provided some advice, actually, to the people involved. The plan is not really a strong one, but it is okay, I would say. The strong thing about the plan is that, and I attended that session at the COP22 in Marrakesh, where the German Minister for the Environment presented it as a confirmation that Germany is sort of honoring our climate pledges. And in particular, she emphasized that this means phase out of emissions, fossil emissions, by 2050, 95% or something. Germany will actually go for the higher end of reductions, while other European countries might not be able to achieve that much, so to speak. And that was a big relief for the people in Marrakesh, because it was the first major industrialized country that did it. So the sheer fact that it was announced and Germany did not falter or go back in any way after Trump's election, that made people confident, actually, and it, in my view, created a chain reaction in Marrakesh, because no single country who joined the Paris Agreement, no single country except the US, so to speak, said we will go back, we will retreat from our agreement. We will not lower our ambitions. So that was very important. In the end, everybody held their breath what China would say. But China also confirmed they will go forward. So the interesting thing is, I talked also to Californian colleagues, somehow it seems now that a new coalition is emerging, strange bedfellows indeed, namely California, Germany and China, which is probably the axis of innovation in this world now.
Axis of innovation. I haven't heard that one before. And that's where future jobs will come from, you think?
I mean, I looked at the Californian example in particular. I mean, California is creating more than 35% of the US GDP. You have to imagine, it's the sixth strongest economy in the world. I think in terms of export, it's even higher, really. So California, certainly Europe, if we come to grips with our internal struggles, I mean, we will certainly sorely miss the UK as probably the best partner we had over the last 40 years and so on.
In climate change?
In everything, I think. In education, I mean, I lived and worked in the UK. This was completely natural to do that within the European agreements. I think we have so many things in common, so it's very sad. I was a visiting professor at Oxford University, research director of the Tyndall Center. It was only natural that we work like if we would live in the same country. And I hope there will not be too many obstacles in the way in the future. But, I mean, Europe in general, plus China and a few other emerging Asian economies, that is where the action is, that's where the innovation is. I mean, take away Silicon Valley from the United States. What is left? Coal industry, steel industry, all that things. So all the action, all the new things are going on the coast, actually. Many things will go on in China and in old Europe, which isn't so old.
Let me ask you about Europe. Climate policy in Europe used to be world leader, now seems to be wobbling or certainly less ambitious. What will be the Trump effect on European climate policy?
Now, first of all, let me tell you why Europe is not a leader anymore. It certainly has to do simply with the financial crisis, the fallout, which, by the way, is also had a major impact on the United States, I think. So it was not really digested. And holding together the European Union and the European currency and so on is a major job. It's a gigantic task, more or less on the shoulders of Angela Merkel in this case. So climate change did not fall between the cracks, but it simply was pushed to the back burner because people thought we just have to make sure that European Union is not imploding. But I know that the European leaders are well aware of this challenge. And I guess we will rearrange ourselves. With the Trump election now, I mean, there are just two alternatives, really. And I think it is precisely what the best sentence that was said during the US campaign was by Michelle Obama. She said, if we go lower, we go higher. So that didn't work out for Hillary Clinton. But I think it's the only motto we can sort of consider. So if the U.S. will more or less drop out as a reliable partner in climate action, we need to do more, actually. And it will in the end benefit our own economy, I'm pretty sure. You will not make the big profits in the future by selling coal.
If you think about the role of Mrs. Merkel in what's happened in Germany recently and what's happened in the EU in terms of climate change, how much of a pivotal role has she played?
I mean, she played a pivotal role all the way, actually. Ever since I met her in 1994, she always was a strong supporter of climate action. Sometimes she had to behave tactical, of course. Sometimes a window opened, a door opened, and when you could increase your climate ambitions and so on. But I think she really stayed the course all the time. So without her, the European Union would certainly have a much less ambitious policy on climate change.
And the world as well, because Germany led the way with those subsidies for solar panels, which eventually have led to the massive revolution in solar, and the world owes Germany a great debt.
Absolutely.
I chair conferences and I ask people to applaud the Germans
in
gratitude for the extraordinary gift the Cloudy Nation gave to the world.
Yeah, Roger, you're very kind, and I have to say it was a historical glitch, I guess, because nobody expected this law to have such an impact. But in the end, I think even the majority of the German people are even proud about this role Germany played, and we still pay a lot of money for it.
Let me ask you about the US. I don't know if through your years you've ever come across Myron Ebel, the man who's going to be running things in the States. Do you know Myron?
Yeah, I met him once, I think, but I know, of course, what he has written and so on. I mean, I think Trump is simply delivering on his promises. He's a gambler, of course. He's a showman and a gambler. And I think he just enjoys to disrupt the system, actually. And so I guess he will put together an extremely reactionary cabinet, really. And of course, I think he will have a very good laugh at thinking about putting a climate skeptic as head of the EPA, whatever. So that will happen. It's a big insinuation. It's a big opera, really, in the end, but it can destroy the world.
It's a big opera.
It is an opera, but it's not an operetta, so to speak. It's not a comedy, it's a tragedy.
Right. Okay, on that note, the way we're ending all these interviews is asking people whether they're optimistic.
I mean, I more or less have said okay. I was asked recently at a panel discussion, a huge public, I was asked, the German environment minister was sitting next to me, and I was asked what the probability, since I'm a scientist, I always have to calculate probability, even if it's not possible. What's the probability that we can still stabilize the climate? When I said, and it was a tongue-in-cheek calculation, which I wrote down in my recent book. I said 19%, 19%. And where's this?
19% likelihood that...
That we can save the climate, 19. And people said, oh my God. And I said, no, this is a fair chance, actually. I mean, it could be 1%, it could be even less. If it's 19%, that means almost one-fifth. This is a fair chance, and we have to go for it. So in this sense, I'm a 20%
optimist. 19%
optimist. Yeah,
you are. Let's not exaggerate.
Okay. Well said, Roger. Thanks for correcting me.
Thanks very much.